Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Net at Night is brought to you by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is Net at Night with Amber MacArthur and Leo Laporte, episode 79 for December 16th, 2008. Don Tapscott, Grown Up Digital. Net at Night is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook and a whole lot more, visit audible.com/night, N-I-G-H-T. It's time for Net at Night, the show where we talk about all the cool things happening on the World Wide Web. From Petaluma, California, I'm Leo Laporte.
And I'm Amber MacArthur from Central Florida.
Are you still in Florida?
I'm still in Florida. I have to go home this weekend, though. But I told you, Leo, I am a young snowbird.
You're living it up. Living up.
I am.
The cold weather in Canada. But we are going to go to Canada for this episode because we have a fellow Torontonian on the line with us.
We do. We have Don Tapscott on the line. And although I think, Don, am I right to say that you're in Chicago?
No, I'm not. I was supposed to be, but I'm in an airport in Toronto on my way to Chicago.
Stuck, gotcha. No doubt, because you never, never, ever fly into Chicago in the winter.
What's with weather in Chicago?
I don't know what that is. Don is the author of a big bestseller called Wikinomics. And Growing Up Digital, he's now you could say it's a sequel to Growing Up Digital because it's Grown Up Digital, How the Net Generation is Changing Your World. Don is the chairman of the Engenera Innovation Network, an adjunct professor of management at the Rotman School of Management, University of Toronto. And it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here, as it were.
Do you want to, I get Wikinomics was the first book, right?
No, Wikinomics was my 12th book.
12th book? Oh, I left out a few.
Well, half of them have been bestsellers and half of them, well, let's say my mother enjoys my books. I wrote the book in 1981 about the internet. And if it wasn't for mom, I think nobody would have read it.
Wait a minute. But, there was no internet in 1981. I mean, 81 was like there was no web anyway. That was very early.
No. In 1977 at Bell Northern Research, we had 100 people on multifunction workstations, essentially using Microsoft Office. And I was getting as many emails back then as I get today, 30 years later. So
really? And but why is that? Because those 400 people wrote a lot? 100 people wrote a lot of emails? Or
No, that was just in one office. And then we were connected on the ARPANET to all the other Bell Northern laboratories and outside to the academic community.
I'm very interested by what insights you had in 1981 and whether here we are, 27 years later, if they held true.
Well, the big idea back then, if you can believe it, this is pre-PC, right? 5 years before the PC, was that computers would be used by people other than secretaries and programmers.
No, never happened.
What a concept.
No, but back then people said it would never happen.
Right.
And you know why?
Why?
They said, I will never learn to type. All these big profundities about a vast new network of networks are going to transform the nature of knowledge work and the business models of enterprises. We're all reduced to this stupid little issue of, really, you can learn to type.
Well, in fact, I do. I remember, in fact, even as recently as just a few years ago, many executives, business executives, didn't use computers because they didn't type. And they have people who do that. But boy, that was a disadvantage, wasn't it?
Well, back then, it was a big problem because there was a status thing. Like, if you used a keyboard, that meant you were a clerical person.
Right.
Or a pro.
Right. The boss didn't type. Yeah.
But, Don, what was the name of your book back then, just out of curiosity?
Well, that book was called Office Automation. It's out of print, but you can get one for a couple hundred bucks used on Amazon.
That's fascinating.
And then I wrote another book that nobody read. And then finally I wrote Paradigm Shift, as you may remember.
Oh,
that was
course.
1991. And
of
that
course.
Was that was a huge book. And then A Digital Economy in 1995 was the first big book about the internet. That was a bestseller. And then I wrote Growing Up Digital. And then that was 1997. And I wrote a book called Digital Capital that was also a bestseller, and a book called The Naked Corporation. But in between those, I wrote a book about privacy in 95. It was called Who Knows? Safeguarding Your Privacy in a Network World. And everyone looked at me like, huh? Like, what's the big issue?
Right.
And so that one went nowhere either. But timing is everything.
I think you could republish that now, Don, and you probably have a pretty big audience.
Yeah, you should just release a new version of that one.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, as you know, in Grown Up Digital, that's a big part of the whole chapter of the book, because I'm very concerned about this issue, and I think young people are blowing their privacy online. That's one big dark side issue.
I tell my daughter that all the time. In fact, there's this trend in high schools and colleges now. They call them gossip girls, where there's a gossip blog, and very sordid personal details are revealed about people in the school.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're right. It has a horrendous potential effect on their future.
Well, you're a good dad to be on her case, as all parents should be, you know, because the privacy controls, for example, on Facebook are very good now, but kids don't use them. It's a big problem.
That's one thing.
Go ahead.
So I was just going to say, when I was reading through the book, that's one thing you did talk about, is how the privacy controls are great, but it's such a small percentage of people who use them. And I've had the same experience just speaking to different groups of people, where I'll have corporations who say, okay, I want my kids to use privacy controls, but there's none in Facebook. And ultimately, they just can't find them or figure out how to use them.
Yeah. Well, the backdrop, of course, is all very positive, but there is this kind of dark side issue.
Well, kids who have grown up digital, is it your sense that they are a little more savvy about these things than we who did not?
Well, I think that they're savvy about some things. They've got great BS detectors, for example, and because there's so much BS on the internet.
Yeah.
And the basic story here is that I started studying kids, I don't know, 15 years ago, when I noticed how my own children were effortlessly able to use all the sophisticated technology. And at first I thought they were prodigies. And but then I noticed all their friends
were like
them. That's
because they're your kids, right?
So, but their friends were like them. So that was a bad theory. So I worked with these 300 kids, and I wrote Growing Up Digital. But if you think about the web back then, there was no MySpace or Skype or blogging or Twitter or YouTube. The web was dial-up. And the internet was basically websites. It was a platform for the presentation of content. But what I saw in these kids is that they were primarily using the web for communications and to collaborate through ICQ and these other tools. And it's sort of a case in point about one of the big ideas in Grown Up Digital, is that if you listen to young people, you will see the future in terms of the new culture of work. You'll see the new marketplace and the new brand. You'll see the new school and the new model of pedagogy. And you'll also see the new networked society. Exhibit A for that is they just elected their first president. So these kids have no fear of technology, because it's not technology to them. It's sort of like the air. And flash forward to today, you know, a billion people have come on the internet since I wrote Growing Up Digital. And I think there's no more powerful force to change every institution in society than this, than a generation of digital natives.
What did we learn from the election in the U.S. that certainly was heavily influenced by the internet? And it was pretty clear generational difference between Obama and McCain, and Obama's ability to use the internet and his team's ability to use the internet.
Yeah. Well, it's, again, the intersection of demographics and technology, a new generation and a new web. And Obama understood that. You know, people say, well, it was only a few states where youth actually made the difference. But I think they're misreading it. If you look at something like Florida, Obama won handily, but the actual vote was very close. And the difference was young people. But it's not just that. It's that young people were encouraging their parents and grandparents to vote for him. This was not an election in a traditional sense. It was a social movement that he created. Now, I estimate there were 20 million young people engaged. And I first got clued into this thing. I was a couple of years ago, and somebody said sent me an email saying, you know, the senator from Obama, from Illinois, has got this thing called MyBarackObama.com, and in it is a community called the Wiccanomics community.
Mm.
You know, so there was a community based around my book,
mm-hmm.
the idea that my book is the key to getting this guy elected. So I thought, well, that's cool. There's a senator, and I'm right in the center of his campaign, until I went there and found out there's also a young firefighters in Houston for Obama community as well. And, you know, the old model of the election was that, you know, you broadcast to people and you pitch them and do negative ads and you raise money in traditional ways and so on. And Obama, a lot has been said about, yeah, he raised money on the internet and, you know, he sent out billions of emails and, you know, and so on. But the really big thing he did is he created a platform whereby people, in particular young people, could self-organize.
Right.
And now he's got a movement. Of course, he's got a tiger by the tail, too. If he stands up on Inauguration Day and says to the 20 million young people, gee, thanks a lot for getting me elected. Now you go be passive for
right.
4 years.
We'll see you in 4 years. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is going to flow.
One thing that you write about in the book as well is that, I mean, I think we're all believers in this movement and we all think it's pretty much a good thing. But there are those people out there who are so skeptical and think that the net generation is a very selfish generation, a generation that is totally obsessed with their own priorities and doesn't really think about the outside world. But in your book, you argue that that's not necessarily true.
Well, in fact, it's untrue. And these kids are getting a bum rap. Just earlier today on the BBC, I debated a guy named Mark Barreline, and he's written a book called The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. And it's like, if you look at all the pundits and the books, you know, a book by Gene Twenge called Generation Me, we've created a little army of narcissists,
mm-hmm.
and they don't give a damn about anything. They're net addicted, glued to the screen, losing their social skills. Robert Bly says the internet is eating the neocortex of youth today. You know, they're violent, they're bullies, they steal intellectual property, they cheat, they're coddled, they mooch off their parents, they move back home after university, they got a bad work ethic. And there's one problem with this whole negative stereotype of youth. It's not based on any data.
Yeah.
And I conducted the biggest investigation ever of this generation, $4 million project. In fact, it was the biggest study of any generation. And what I concluded is that these cynics are making this stuff up. This generation is not the dumbest. It's the smartest. You know, youth crime is down year over year for 15 years. Civic engagement by high school students and universities is up year over year for 15 years. You know, more young people voted in this election than ever before, not just in raw numbers, which was huge, but in terms of the percent. Of young people. This is a generation we can be enormously positive about and hopeful about. In the book, I actually developed a neologism, you know, a newly invented word to refer to these people. I called it a new disorder called engenophobia, a morbid fear of youth with regard to their use of the internet.
And not just not just youth, but new things in general, frankly. Let's face
well,
it, right?
Well, we've always been uneasy about youth.
Yeah.
Throughout history.
Sure.
You know,
they're terrifying. They're younger. They're more energetic.
Yeah, they're to be, youth is wasted
on the
young. They
don't like us much.
You know, children are to be seen and not heard.
Right,
I mean,
right.
This goes back in the book. Right. I'm quoting Aristotle about how young people have bad manners and they mooch off their parents
right.
and so on.
Right.
But you combine that with the fact that we have a new medium of human communications that's transforming every institution in society, and the young people know more about it than the older
right.
people.
Right. Terrifying.
This is a formula for fear.
Yeah.
You know, I called it the generation lap. Back in the 60s, we had a generation gap. Big differences between kids and parents over values and lifestyle. And kids and parents get along pretty well. I mean, look at your iPod and your kid's iPod. There's overlap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, my parents didn't even like the Beatles, let
right.
alone you know,
right.
the Doors.
Right.
But what we have today is what I call a generation lap, where this is the first time in human history when children are an authority about something really important. I was an authority on model trains when I was a kid. Today, the 11-year-old at the breakfast table is an authority in this thing that's changing everything.
It's interesting, though. These kids, and I'm looking at my own 14 and 16-year-old. You have kids also. Many of them are not enthusiasts about technology in the way that our generation might be. You know, it's, you know, we're like the stereophiles. We go, oh, cool, speeds and feeds. This is just part of their life. So they don't exactly treat it as, ooh, isn't this cool, exciting stuff? It's just part of their life.
Well, I think that's profound, what you just said. In fact, let me take it further. They don't even view it as technology.
No.
It's right. Like the air.
Right.
You know?
Any more than we think of a toaster as technology.
Yeah, when your daughter's online, she's chatting with her friends. She's not thinking, whoa, this real-time synchronous IP.
Right. No, not at all.
Network. Really, right. She's thinking what her friend said.
Actually, the funniest thing you wrote in your book, at least funny to me, is because Leo and I have worked together doing technology shows on television, is when you're writing in your book how I think it was your son who said you had gone on a television show a few years ago and you were talking about surfing the internet and he was saying, that's so uncool, Dad. That's like going on and saying, this is how you find different channels on TV.
It's a good insight.
My kids are amazed. You know, like my dad is a refrigerator guru. Yeah,
you can make money on that, Dad.
Refrigerator's technology. Everyone's so fascinated by his knowledge of the refrigerator.
But I want to take a break, though, and mention our friends at GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is done by Citrix, which is a fantastic company. These guys really know how to, they know the internals of Windows better than anybody. In fact, they wrote a lot of it. That's probably why, going back to NT, the early NT days. And they are they do the best meeting software for Windows just because they understand it. These guys know the internals. I'm talking about GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting lets you meet anywhere with anybody over the internet. No travel. You don't waste time and money getting from place to place. You just have a conference call, but it's so much better than a conference call because suddenly your screen is on their desktop. I mean, they see your PowerPoint or the documents you guys are working on together. I've used it for demonstrations, product demos. Sometimes companies will say, we'd like you to see our new software. They'll show me using GoToMeeting. Or, as I mentioned before, I worked on a speech. It was great. We rehearsed the whole speech because GoToMeeting's fast. It's real time. So he ran the PowerPoint. He was in, back east. And he ran the PowerPoint. And we went through this. We were on the phone together. GoToMeeting has VoIP built in, too, by the way. Works on Mac and PC. And it is amazing. I want you to try it right now for 30 days free. Free, a month of unlimited online meetings, absolutely free. Just go to gotomeeting.com/night. gotomeeting.com/night, and you get 30 days free. It installs in a couple of minutes. And the nice thing is for your clients, you know, the people you're sending the meeting invitation to, there's nothing. They don't have to do anything ahead of time. They either click the link in the email that you send them saying, you know, we have a meeting, or it actually works automatically with Outlook to create the meeting, or you just say on the phone, hey, go to gotomeeting.com, here's the meeting ID. They enter in that what is it, 6-digit number, and all of a sudden it's just doing it. They're seeing your computer on their desktop. It is remarkable. Try it free for 30 days. Go to gotomeeting.com/night. Give it a try. I've used it. Amber uses it. We all love it. We thank them so much for their support of Net at Night. Now let's get back to our conversation. Well, we pay a lot of attention to the fact that kids don't watch TV anymore. They watch YouTube and Hulu. They have screen time, but the screen time is all with the computer. But they don't think of it that way. They don't make that distinction at all.
No. Well, but that gets to a really key point, too, is that all this stuff about kids are net addicted and this is melting their brain and so on. Time online for young people today compared to their parents, the baby boomers, when they were growing up, time online is not taken away from hanging out with your friends, learning the piano, talking to your parents, doing your homework, or playing football. Hmm. It's taken away from television.
TV, yeah.
The baby boomers watch 24 hours a week of TV per kid. And these kids watch a lot less TV, and they watch it differently. Yep. They come home, and they turn on their computer, and they're in three different windows and chatting on their phone, actually more likely texting on the phone. And they get three magazines open and a video game going, and they're listening to MP3 files, and there's Skype happening. And, oh, yeah, they're doing their homework at the same time. And in the background, the TV may be going on, but it's sort of like ambient media. It's like Muzak.
No, I see that in my kids, absolutely.
Affects their brain.
Are their brains different? They're processing different?
Well, think about it. This critical period of adolescence, it's age 8 to 18, when the deep structures and synaptic connections of the brain are being formed, how you spend your time after your DNA is the big factor that affects what your brain is like.
Yeah.
And if you grow up watching TV for 24 hours a week, you get a certain kind of brain. And if you grow up, you know, being the active handler, manipulator of media and collaborator and scrutinizer and authenticator and organizer of information with video games, you know, developing strategies, having to remember things. This affects your brain as well. These kids have different brains.
You don't think video games are bad for kids?
Well, if your kid is playing, World of Warcraft for 70 hours a week, that's a problem. Kids need balance.
Right.
But if they have balance, this is wonderful.
Yeah.
All the research shows that it develops all kinds of cognitive, perceptual, memory, intelligence, all kinds of other parts of brain function, perception. I mean, even something like multitasking. What's going on there is that the kids have better switching ability. So they're actually not multitasking. They just switch better. And they have better active working memory, so that they can move between things easier than I can. Well, this is something that's a desirable characteristic.
One thing that you just mentioned there is memory, and I think I read somewhere online today where you had been interviewed and you were talking about the idea of memorizing content or information and how it's less important these days to actually memorize, you know, historical facts than it used to be, because you can just get that information at the click of a mouse.
Yeah, I'm told by my publicist that the entire city of London is in a huge flap over this interview that I did. I got 6 calls from the BBC today. I've already done 3 interviews. I just did an interview for an education reporter for the Times. And I said, look, I think the model of pedagogy is wrong, and the kids shouldn't be, we shouldn't have a model that's focused on kids learning facts and remembering stuff so that you can recall it on tests.
You're absolutely right.
Said,
that's ridiculous.
I said that, you know, that used to be you graduated, you were set for life, and you kept up in your chosen field. Well, today you graduate, you're set for 15 minutes.
Right. You know, facts are easy. It's finding, it's how to find facts and how to use the facts you find that's hard.
Right. Of course, you need, you know, a basic body of factual information. But, you know, we don't need a generation who can perform well on tests. We need a generation who can think and learn lifelong and reinvent their knowledge base and communicate and put things in context. So apparently the entire British school system disagrees with me, according to the blogosphere.
Well, it does. The way it's designed, the way pedagogy is designed, I've been saying this for a long time. It's apparent when I see what my kids are being taught in school. They're not being taught how to think. They're not being taught critical thinking. Fortunately, they're learning it, aren't they? You said at the very beginning, they have good BS detectors now.
Yeah. Well, The other thing that's happening there, of course, that the model of pedagogy is also wrong. Like, it's a one-way broadcast model based on lecture.
Right.
You know, hey, listen up. I'm a teacher. I have knowledge. You're a student. You're an empty vessel. You don't get ready. Here it comes.
Right.
You know,
right.
And your goal is to take it into memory and through practice and repetition, build deeper structures so you can recall it to me when I test you. Drill and kill. And sage on the stage. A great definition of a lecture in the book. It's the process whereby the notes of a lecturer go to the notes of a student without going through the brains of either.
That's true.
I love it.
But kids they don't learn that way.
Isn't it irrelevant, though? Aren't kids feeding their needs without? It just makes school more and more irrelevant for the kids today.
Well, you know what's happening? All the smartest kids in universities in the U.S. don't go to lectures.
Right.
The big thing is to get an A without going to the lecture.
They're gaming it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And they, if you know, I'm going to miss my lecture on organizational development because I'm going to go hear Peter Drucker talk about the same issue.
Right.
You know, and I can fast forward through it too.
Right.
You know, and so You know, I'll tell you guys a story because we have a second year. I never get to tell this story, but I was at, this is pertinent. I was at Florida State University, and they brought me in to talk about this whole topic because they wanted to create a 21st century university. So I was there over a long lunch, and I was going through this. We need a whole new teacher-focused, customized, collaborative model of, student-focused, customized, collaborative model of learning because these kids learn differently, and this is a better model. So one of the deans says to this youngster, his name is Joe O'Shea, he's 22 years old, sitting in the room. What do you think? And Joe says, well, this resonates with me. He says, I think we do learn differently. Let me give you an example. I don't read books. Hmm. And there's like, everyone is aghast all around the table. And he says, I think I know what's in books, but I access knowledge through the web. And if I need to know something in a book through Google Books, I can get any chapter of a book. And I'm good at doing that. And so the dean of the film school, smart guy, says, I don't know if this is really interesting and positive or if it means the end of civilization. So I had a charter plane for the day, and he was going up to where I was going, Fort Lauderdale. So I said, come on, Joe, hop in. I'll give you a ride. I want to get to know you. So I'm talking to this kid on the plane, interviewing him. I said, what kind of student are you? He says, I'm good. I said, how good? He says, well, I'm straight A's. And I said, what else do you do outside of school? He says, well, I'm president of the Florida State Students Council. I got a budget of $15 million. I'm on 18 university committees. And I said, whoa, you do other stuff? And he says, well, I've been pretty active in some social stuff. I said, yeah, tell me. He says, well, my girlfriend's from New Orleans, and when Katrina hit, we went down there to see what we could do. There was no health clinic in the Ninth Ward, so I set one up. And it's still functioning today. It's really cool. 9,000 people. He says, I'm also the head of a global peace exchange. Me and a couple of buddies founded that. And we're hoping to have a global summit of heads of state.
See how much more time you have when you don't read books?
Or watch TV.
But get the punchline here. So I said, tell me about your family. And he says, well, it's sort of a touchy issue right now because both my parents passed away this year. And I'm the oldest sibling, so we play World of Warcraft together because they're in different cities, and that's how I keep the family together. I said, what are you doing next year? He says, well, I'm going to London. I'm really excited because I'm going to get British healthcare. He says, we had a poor family. We just never went to the doctor, and he knows all about British healthcare. He's a deeply knowledgeable kid. So I said, well, so what are you doing in London? He says, well, I'm taking a master's of philosophy at Oxford. Like, Oxford's as hard as place to get into in the world. And I said, cool, have you got any financial aid? And he said, yeah, I got a scholarship. And I said, really? What is it? He says, it's called the Rhodes Scholarship.
It's this thing called the Rhodes.
Oh, my God.
But now this is an outlier, Don. This is not...
He's an outlier, but you can learn from that. The smartest kid in Florida
says he doesn't read books.
That's really interesting. So, you know what else I find interesting is just when you started to tell us that story, you mentioned that you don't usually have a lot of time to tell this. And it's funny because I did an interview for a Toronto radio station recently, and literally the interview was a minute and a half long. And I barely had time to say anything. It was about Facebook and privacy, and there was just no time at all. And it's so interesting because I think in longer format, media, like our podcasting and doing the show right now, I think that's what people want, at least a younger generation, is to be able to dive deep into content. And you talk a little bit about that in your book as well. They may not read books, but when they want information, they want to be able to go deep.
And they want it on demand.
Well, sure. And this thing about kids, you know, they're not into depth, and they don't want to, they can't focus and so on. You know, I asked a guy named Jim Quigley, he's the CEO of Deloitte. Okay, he hires thousands of young people every year globally. And I said, is it true they're the dumbest generation, they can't focus? He says, they're the most focused, most disciplined, and smartest generation ever. And I said, give me some evidence. He says, for me, it's simple. They bill more, and they have happier clients than previous generations ever did.
We have to take a break. I want to take a little bit of a break, Don. But when we come back, I want to ask you a couple of things. I do want to ask about this kind of ADD issue, this issue that certainly those of us from an earlier generation, and I'll include you, Amber, on this, because when he talks about kids, he's talking about people, you know, in their 20s and younger, who feel like we've become almost fragmented, ADD, because of this super flow of information. And I'd like to know how the younger people are dealing with that. I'd also like to talk about what it means going forward for the future, you know, for this generation as they grow up, what our world is going to look like as they become the people in power. But before we do that, I want to mention Audible.com. Now, Don only has one book on Audible. I'm sad to say, out of all those books, Wikinomics is on Audible, right?
That's disgraceful.
Isn't that disgraceful?
Yeah. We recommended Wikinomics last week.
Don, we're going to talk to Don Katz and make sure that we get... Actually, probably your publisher has more to do that with that than anybody, Don.
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
We'll get them to... You know, one of the things Audible's been doing, they've built studios, and they are record... It's because many publishers don't record audio versions of their books. And I think probably your books, they probably figure they're too intellectual for audiobooks. You know, people want thrillers. A lot of publishers think that nonfiction doesn't work in audio. And I'm here to tell you, it works great in audio. And I love listening to business books, books like this. Malcolm Gladwell's books now are mostly on audio in audible.com. And I would love to see all of Don Tatzkatz's books in there. But certainly Wikinomics would be a great one to start with. And that's going to be our Audible recommendation for the week. Here, you can get it for free. Here's the good news. Go to audible.com/night. Audible.com/night. And sign up for an Audible Gold account today. And you'll get a credit toward a book absolutely free. Even if you don't stick around, you get to keep that book. And I think Wikinomics would be a really good choice for you to pick up. If you like what you're hearing today, Don is really insightful. And there's a lot of information, and it's narrated not by Donald, although I think you should be doing your own reading, frankly, but that's a lot of work. Maybe who has time for that? A guy named Alan Sklar reads it. How mass collaboration changes everything. And speaking as somebody who's been using mass collaboration, crowdsourcing and the like for some time, I will give you absolutely, you're absolutely right. Fascinating. It really challenges a lot of what we think is true, as do all of Don's books, with real facts. This is based on another research project you did, a $9 million research project you did on how people participate in the economy. Fascinating study. Very good book. Highly recommend it. Wikinomics, How Mass Collaboration Changes Everything. And you can get it right now by going to audible.com/night. audible.com/night. 51,000 books. You click them, download them within minutes. You'll have it on your iPod, your iPhone, your Sansa. Some people listen on their GPS devices because it's in the car and they can listen there. Hundreds of different devices. You can even burn CDs and listen in your car or listen on your computer. I am a huge Audible fan, whether you're commuting, working in the garden. That kid may not read books, but I bet you anything that he uses his downtime, those times when you can't be reading or you can't be online listening, it is a very efficient way to consume information. Audible.com/night. We thank them so much for their support of Net at Night. And I'm glad. It's nice to have somebody on the show whose book I can plug.
I know. It's great.
Thank you.
Worked out well.
My publisher told me that the Amazon listed sales figures annually per year. And Wikinomics was a top 10 book in 2007 for business books, but it was arguably the only management book on the list because the others are, you know, self-help or investing. And so on. So that they are saying that according to Amazon sales figures, Wikinomics was the number one management book in the U.S. last year. So it's kind of cool.
The new one is on Kindle, by the way. So if you're a Kindle reader, you can get Grown Up Digital on Kindle. If I can't get it on Audible, that's how I'll do it, because it's just that way I can have all these books. I think in some ways I am like this kid. I dip into these books. A lot of times that's a really good way to do it. What do you think we're ADD? Do you think we are, we lose our ability, our attention span?
Well, here's the problem with that. It's a question of how you define attention. Like if someone apparently can do five tasks at once, which young people can do, they can do it a lot easier than we can because their brains enable that because they have better working memory and they have better switching abilities. Is that ADD or is that just good attention focused on a number of things?
Right.
Okay. So let me build a case here. Secondly, in the workplace, they can be enormously focused. We've seen all that evidence. Thirdly, they're graduating from university like never before. You would think university requires some focus and discipline to graduate. Standards have gone up. It's tougher to get into universities now than before. We know that IQ is going up year over year for a long time. We know that SAT scores have gone up or may remain stable, even though the number of kids taking the SAT has exploded. So that should have brought the scores down, because it used to be only the smartest kids from the elite schools that took the SAT. And then, you know, so I just, this is all kind of evidence that comes together. You see a kid focus like a laser on a video game for 3 hours, seeming to have rather good attention span. So I think this whole attention span thing is, it's one of these kind of loaded terms. That it's like net addiction, you know. I got into a period of several months when I was just loving the Hardy Boy books when I was, I don't know, 12 or something. Right. And I go in my bedroom and read Hardy Boy books for like 4 hours a day. My parents thought it was kind of cool. They didn't say I was book addicted or reading addicted or something. Yeah. So we have these pejorative terms to describe what we don't understand. And it's really fear that's driving it. Now, if a young person is working on an essay, I've told my kids, you know, reduce the distractions, get focused. But they do that naturally. The libraries are full of kids who in the universities who go in there because they just got to get away from the dorm so they can actually get some work done.
It's interesting you should say that. I wandered into the library. I went to my college reunion and wandered into the new library, and I'd never seen so many kids in there, certainly not in my generation. It was jammed and very quiet, and they were all working.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. Well, all right. So good. So we're not ADD, Amber. We're just able to process more things.
I need you to talk to my parents, Don. That would be very good for me.
But you know, a funny thing happens, because I give probably 120 speeches a year to all kinds of different audiences. And what I expect at the book signing afterwards is people to come up and say, "Don, you're so profound," or something. They don't. The main thing they're saying when I give a grown-up digital speech is, "Thank you. You helped me understand my kids better."
Yeah.
It's not what I expected at all.
Right. It's really interesting, though, because one thing that I always wonder is that, like I said, when I read through this book and when Leo reads through it, you know, we're all kind of agreeing with a lot of what you have to say. But how do you get those people who don't really buy into this? How do you get them to understand this generation and to understand that they are different?
Well, other than suggesting everyone purchase Grown Up Digital in massive volume.
Brilliant. He's brilliant.
He's good.
You know, there's a lot that can be done. I mean, what I say to people is, first of all, personal use is a precondition for any kind of comprehension about both the new web and also about the technology. So get your kid to take you onto Facebook. You know, go onto a wiki you know, go say Don Tapscott is the world's leading accordion player. Untrue. And to see what happens. You know, people will be all over that in seconds. So see how a wiki works. One of the groups of people that will be all over that is accordion players saying, "Who the hell is Don Tapscott? Guy doesn't even have a CD." Go on to Twitter. I mean, it seems weird at first, but it's, you know, I've got clients now that are using microblogging as sort of a new metabolism for how they run their business. You know, just go post something on YouTube. So that's a first one. A second one is, wow, you know, we can learn so much from our kids. I have three formal reverse mentoring relationships with young people.
I love that. Reverse mentoring. There's a good concept.
It actually goes both ways. Like, I sat down with one of my mentors this morning, and it's a very good friend of my daughter's, actually, because the other two are my two kids.
Right.
And she was giving me all this stuff about, she was deeply involved in the Obama campaign in Chicago, and she's got the whole inside story. Her name's Rahaf Harfush. Has a fabulous blog called The Fush, F-O-U-S-H. So she was giving me all these great insights about, you know, what happened in the Obama campaign and cool tools and their iPod application and their iPhone application and so on. And I was trying to give her some context on, because I've been around, you know, what does all this mean? What might it mean for marketing? What might it mean for the corporation? And every time we sit down, we have an amazing conversation. So those kinds of things can be institutionalized everywhere, in the corporation, in the universities, in the family, for sure. Governments, I mean, Obama is smart. He's got young people everywhere. And that kind of two-way mentoring thing is something that's extraordinary, and it's new, and it's a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the idea of just sort of listening to younger people and listening to what they have to say and kind of teaching them. I know I'm always teaching my parents how to use different tools, just got them up on Twitter with their business. And it really does take kind of educating them a little bit. But once you do, I think they realize the value quite quickly.
So yeah. Go ahead.
This plays out in the corporation. So all these young people come into a company. And they're in their culture is a culture of collaboration and customization, innovation and speed and authentication and scrutiny and collaboration, all the other things that I talk about in Grown Up Digital. And then they bump into Dilbert Inc., you know, and they get put into a cubicle and someone says, "Hi, I'm your boss." A boss is someone who's an authority on everything in our business unit. And the young person's thinking, "Well, just a sec, you know, I've been an authority on something really important since I was 11. Could we have different ways of working here?" So what companies are doing right now is not what I'm describing. They're doing the opposite. Rather than embracing this culture and trying to learn from it, they do stupid things like ban the tools. You know, banning Facebook is popular sport these days. Mm-hmm. And social networks are the new operating system of business. And what do companies do? They ban them. So I was talking to the CIO of a state recently, and the governor had banned Facebook. And so I said to the CIO, "Well, why did he do that?" He says, "Well, the governor says young people are wasting their time at work." To which I reply, "Is this a technology problem? You know, if young people are wasting their time, isn't that a management problem? It has to do with workflow and job design and motivation and so on." I said, "What was the effect of banning Facebook?" He says, "Well, everybody went to MySpace."
Well,
I asked another youngster, "What was the effect of banning Facebook?" He said, "It was the single most demoralizing thing that management has ever done. It says, we don't understand collaboration, we don't understand your technology, and we don't trust you."
I wonder if, certainly as a parent I see this, and I imagine employers too, if we're not trying to shoehorn these kids into this old way of doing things, because we just don't have the structure to do it the new way. Is it just going to take this generation just reinventing what it means to work, what it means to be in business? And should we just let them have their head, or is there some way to kind of do this more gradually and collaboratively?
Well, you can do it both ways.
I mean, it's a revolution in a lot of ways.
Well, it is, really. And right now we're talking about the corporation, but we could be talking about learning. We could be talking about government.
Yep.
We could be talking about any institution. So case in point, Brad Anderson. He's the CEO of Best Buy. And he says, the most important people in this company are the tens of thousands of blue shirts who work in the stores. You know, they wear blue shirts. And he says, they're the closest to our customer, they're most like our customer, and in their culture is a new culture of work. And he says, and between them and me are layers of management that are trying to prevent them from reinventing this company for the 21st century. So he says, my job as the CEO is to unleash the power of human capital. That's what I'm trying to do. I have given them a license to self-organize. So sure enough, 25,000 of them self-organize, and they're on this social network called Blue Shirt Nation.
Interesting.
That's completely unauthorized. It's a Skunkworks project. Every week, that thing comes up with dozens of recommendations that get implemented by the company. So they're harnessing this whole power of this new generation that thinks differently and unleashing not just the human capital, but the power of the technology as well.
Man,
Best Buy's a tough market.
They're lucky that they have such an enlightened CEO. I think there's quite a few business executives who say if they get together and organize, we're going to have a union. We're going to have to pay them more. We're not going to be able to stay in business.
Well, except the opposite is the truth.
Right.
You know, last time I was at Best Buy, Brad, I was sitting with a bunch, eight or so young people, and he invited me to sit in on the meeting. And he was basically asking them questions for 2 hours. And then at the end of the meeting, I said, you know, that's a weird meeting. You don't see a CEO talking to 23-year-olds much, where he's just trying to learn from them. And he said, look it, this is how I learn about the future of this company, is by talking to these people. And he said, to your point, Leo, that imagine if I didn't listen to them.
Yeah.
They'd walk out of this room, and half an hour later, there'd be 5,000 people in this company who think I'm a jerk.
Right.
Yeah.
So
right.
They have huge power.
Right.
Period. You know, and the only way to enable them to have power for good is to embrace it and to let go and to harness it. You fight it, and you will end up with problems.
Right.
Or you'll end up with the big problem, which is, you know, they come into the workforce and they don't like what they see and they leave. By the time they're 27, they're on their third job.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a few friends who are in their 20s, early 20s, and when I've spoken to them before about different jobs and their experiences in these different locations, they've said to me before, if they're at a company and the company tells them they can't go on Facebook, they will end up just quitting that job because they don't want someone who won't allow them to do that. Like, there's this real sense that, you know, these are tools that they use to communicate, and cutting them off is completely unjustified.
So here's the question. What is the world going to look like when these kids come into their own? It's a very different world, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is. It is. And, you know, I'm hopeful, and I get a lot of criticism for that, but I'm very hopeful. And we interviewed 11,000 young people in 10 countries all around the world. And they're a generation that has very strong values. They're more diverse than ever. They're smart. They're collaborative. And they are beginning to remake our institutions. There's 80 million of them in the U.S. alone, only 78 million baby boomers. So they're going to dominate the 21st century based on their demographic muscle alone. But what makes them a real force for change is that they're different. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about the corporation. I envisage, and I can see it. I'm not a futurist. I don't predict things. I see today companies like Best Buy are changing very fundamental aspects of their modus operandi as children, young people affect their culture. In the universities, the old model of learning, you know, I'm a prof, listen up, here it comes. That model is changing because the young people are voting with their feet. They're just not going to the lectures. In the family, they're really exciting changes that are underway. I think these kids are going to be great parents because they've learned a lot about technology in the family. And they've learned a lot of, the boomers overall were pretty good parents, you know, they cared a lot about their kids. They may have overprogrammed them a bit. Sure, you got helicopter parents with boomer, you know.
But we were, as a generation, we were pretty
the job.
We were pretty child centric as a generation, at least compared to our parents.
Yeah, and overall, that's like the org chart of the family I grew up in was the mom reported to dad and the kids reported to mom. You know, I was the eldest kid, so the dog reported to me. But Leo, you think of your family. I bet you those two kids are in the middle. And then you and your partner are on the outside. And then you got step-parents or you got, you know, grandparents or whatever. It's a very different model.
You know, it's really interesting, Don. The kids are more, I think, much more autonomous than we were at their age. My daughter, for instance, who was 16, conceived on her own the idea that she would study in France this year, did all the work, and went. And she's in France right now. And I think that showed a real, exactly what you're talking about. And by the way, they all the future students who were on their way to France all collaborated and created a group on Facebook. She knew everybody that she was going to be studying with before they left. It's a very modern thing. I see my son, and I worry a little bit about my son because school doesn't speak to him. And at first, you know, your first reaction is, oh, boy, he's having trouble in school. And that, I think I'm realizing that it doesn't speak to him because it doesn't speak to any kid today. It is that old, as you say, the old model of pedagogy just does not work with these kids.
And we do a great disservice, you know, to young people. We stick them in this old model and, And then we interpret their lack of enthusiasm as
exactly
as boredom, stupidity. That's even worse.
Exactly. That was my initial reaction. It's our initial reaction. And I think I'm starting to come to the realization that, in fact, his reaction is absolutely appropriate given, you know, what he's in, what the environment he's in and the modern age. It's exactly as you say in Grown Up Digital.
But you, and then you go to a big one, which is government, that Obama is going to use this movement in the way he got, just as he got elected, he's going to use it to govern. And I think we're in the early days of some profound changes to the nature of democracy and the relationship between citizens and their state. And in fact, I've been, whenever I can, here's an opportunity, calling on him to be the first head of state to organize a digital brainstorm. It's a three, and I described this in a chapter of Grown Up Digital. It's a three-day conversation of the entire population of a country on the web. And pick a topic, global warming, improving the economy, fixing America's reputation in the world, whatever. And we'll just have a conversation. And it's not about politicians broadcasting to citizens, which is what currently happens. And it's not, this is not direct democracy. It's not about citizens telling politicians what to do. It's about having a conversation. It's about a marketplace for ideas, about people getting engaged, and about initiatives being catalyzed. And that could be a wonderful baby step towards some fundamental changes in the whole nature of the democratic process.
What's interesting is if he doesn't do that, what I'm thrilled about is if he doesn't do that, all of these kids who put him in office are going to call him to his accounts. It's going to happen anyway, I guess, is the bottom line. The times are changing.
That's exactly right. You know, and some people say, no, they'll just go and be passive.
No.
No,
I don't think so.
That with a lot of confidence. You know, when I wrote Grown Up Digital, that chapter that basically said, here's why Obama is going to win, John McCain was in the lead when I wrote that chapter. Yeah. And when I put the book in the can. But I was so confident about my research that the movement of based on young people and the web was being created here that I let that go. And besides, he has every interest in doing this. You know, how are you going to bring about universal health care in the United States? This is not going to be done by some backroom compromise. There are objective interests, you know, entrenched interests in the society that are going to fight against this. The only way you're going to win is with an epic battle where the relationship of forces can change. And that's one of a whole bunch of issues. We're having a movement of 20 million young people on your side. It's kind of helpful. So I think if he's smart, he'll understand that, that, you know, we want real change. Well, this is the way you bring about change in society. You bring about change by mobilizing people and by having the hearts and minds of people engaged.
So, Don, where do you go after Grown Up Digital? You've done Growing Up, Grown Up. What's next?
Well, you know, there is a generation next, the 0 to 12-year-olds. And that's a whole other interesting topic that I'm exploring.
Are they different from their older brothers and sisters?
Yeah, well, they are.
Oh, you know, boy. We just figured these guys out.
I know. Talk about being bathed in bits. I mean, these kids are very different. And you know, in some ways, the future is something to be achieved. It's not something to be predicted. And the way they are will be a function of how we respond. Like, you know, as managers or as marketers or government leaders or educators or parents, how we respond over the next few years to this generation will determine some very big things, actually. And some of them being really big, like the world that we're handing these kids is, need I say it, a bit of a mess.
Yeah.
Pick any topic.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
Yeah.
And we are entrusting this generation with an enormous challenge of trying to make the world that their kids inherit a better one. And, you know, just something like global warming. This is the reindustrialization of the planet. We got 30 years to make some serious progress on this issue. So, boy, I better be right that this is an enormously competent generation with great values and integrity.
Or we're in deep trouble.
Or we're in deep trouble.
Well, and I think there is a price to be paid as the current establishment if we don't allow this new generation their head and allow them to do what they're going to do. They're going to do it anyway. It's going to happen anyway. And we can go kicking and screaming and bring ourselves down, or we can acknowledge it and say, look, this is the future. We need to change the way we educate. We need to change the way we govern. And these guys are on the cutting edge, and this is how it's got to be. The only real choice is how quickly we become irrelevant, frankly.
Well,
it's because it's going to happen.
That's probably not an overstatement.
Yeah.
And the flip side of that is, gee, you know, if you get into this whole movement, into the technology and the young people and so on, it's exhilarating.
It is.
You know, I was at this, I tell this story in Grown Up Digital, but this was when the first book had come out. It was about 10 years ago. And I was at a cocktail party of educators, and a woman came up to me. She was in her 60s, and she said, I just wanted to meet you and tell you that you changed my life. And I'm like, hello? And, you know, tell me about this. And she says, well, I've read Growing Up Digital, and I heard you give a lecture. I'm a math teacher in a high school. And I decided I'm going to do this. And I went and got some support. I got some money. I got some laptops. I don't give lectures anymore. The kids are learning
That's
like they've
so
never
great.
Learned before. I know more about every one of those kids after a month than they did after a year. And she says, I'm a new woman.
Yeah.
I could hardly wait to get up in the morning.
That's so
why,
great.
Why would we all miss an opportunity to reinvent ourselves?
It's a social revolution. It's happening everywhere. And you can get on the bus, or you can wave it goodbye as it leaves the station. A good way to get on the bus is to read the book, Grown Up Digital, brand new from Don Tapscott and published by McGraw-Hill, and not on Audible, but on your Kindle. Also, Growing Up Digital, which was the one that came before, and the book that, and I think in many ways, started this all, Paradigm Shift, which is, I'm sure, still in print, even though it's it's 15 years old now. Classic.
It's almost 20 now.
It's a classic. Don, it's been so great to talk to you. I'd love to spend another 2 hours, but I'm sure you have a plane to catch.
Well, that was a great conversation.
It's fascinating.
Thank you so much, Don. Thanks for taking the time. I know you have a really busy schedule, and hopefully we'll catch up again when the next book comes out.
Sooner.
I'd love to.
Sooner. If you're ever in the Bay Area, please come up and spend some time with us. We'd love to have you on the...
Yeah, I'll do it for sure.
Great. Thank you, Don.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks so much.
Don Tapscott. Again, the book from McGraw-Hill is Grown Up Digital. You know, it's interesting, Amber. Don is a little older than me, but we're both baby boomers. It is possible for us old folks to be part of this transformation. It doesn't have to leave you behind.
Oh, definitely not. I mean, I think it's one of those things that you just have to have that desire to kind of learn and what's happening. And,
yeah. And
I mean, I see with my own parents who are in their 60s, and they're so interested in terms of, you know, how Obama has used the internet. They're interested in Twitter and Facebook, all these different sites. And they really genuinely want to know. And now they know so much more than they used to. And they're comfortable kind of experimenting with some of these tools, using Skype all the time. Like, they don't have... they don't really use a landline to do business while they're down here in Florida. All they use is Skype. So it's amazing to see the transformation, because just a few years ago, they would not have felt comfortable using any of this type of technology.
Well, your parents and Don and me somewhat grew up in the 60s, which was the last big social movement, which unfortunately, I think for those of us who were part of it, it kind of got nipped in the bud, but there was a lot of hope there. I think that the promise of the 60s, we're old hippies, but the promise of the 60s is finally coming true. And it's thanks to digital technology, the internet, these new media. They're really making it possible, this revolution, this change in society that we wanted all, 50 years ago, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
It's finally happening. Fascinating subject.
It really is. And I think, even just reading Grown Up Digital, I'm almost done. But it's a really good book to actually give your parents, for people out there who want to try to help their parents understand it. There's so many great little stories in the book that I think it helps to make it relevant. So it's been a good read so far.
Yeah, I don't think he's over optimistic about this either. I know that he gets some criticism saying, oh, you know, there are a lot of people out there saying the youth today, they're screwed up. And he's saying, screwed up. They're the hope of the future and they're about to change the world. Pay attention. And I think he's right on that. I really do.
I totally agree. Yeah.
And if he's not, we're in deep, deep trouble.
Yep. Big trouble, Leo.
Amber, an unusual show today. We thought we'd just spend some time. It's such a treat to have Don Tapscott for a whole hour. Next week, more Net at Night. We've got some more interviews for you. We wish everybody a happy holiday. We're pre-recording this because I'm going to be in France by the time this airs. But I'm glad we could get this show on the air. I hope you've enjoyed it. You can catch Amber, of course, on Command N. That's her TV, our internet TV show, CommandN.TV. And on Real TV on CP24, part of her Web Nation segments. And let's not forget Butterscotch. She's got a couple of shows on Butterscotch. Is that Butterscotch.com?
Yeah, it's Butterscotch.com. And you can find everything pretty much at AmberMack.com. So, Leo, I'm turning into a mini version of you. You've got a lot going on.
And all good stuff. Thank you, Amber. We'll see you next time on Net at Night.